This is Free Speech Radio News. It's Tuesday, December 23rd, 2008. From KPFA in Berkeley, I'm Brian Edwards Tiegert, sitting in for Aldo Bogado. Federal prosecutors convict five men on charges of conspiracy to attack a military base. Advocates for the Muslim community cry foul and allege entrapment. A coal ash spill in Tennessee buries homes and threatens to flood the state's rivers. So far, it is nearly 50 times the size of the Exxon Valdez. And part two of our series on homelessness. We'll take a look at Canada, where the harsh winter and harsher economy are starting to cost lives on the streets. Those stories and more, but first, the headlines.
I'm Nell Abram with the headlines for Free Speech Radio News. Soldiers in Guinea staged a coup attempt today following the death of the West African nation's president, Lansana Conti. Earlier today, those attempting the coup announced on state radio that the constitution and the government were suspended. They cited broad-based corruption and an economic catastrophe. But Prime Minister Ahmed Tidiane Souare said in comments broadcast by Radio France International that the government is still intact. Officials say negotiations were held, but the situation remains volatile. Most of the people of Guinea live in poverty. The nation has recently seen anti-government riots, strikes, and bloody military uprisings. Legislative elections were already planned for 2009. Hundreds of Nepalese newspapers ran blank editorials today protesting an attack on a reputed media house by Maoist activists. PC Dubey reports.
Some 50 masked Maoists barged into the Himal Media House last Sunday and assaulted its 12 staff, including the editor. The media group publishes a number of Nepali dailies and periodicals which report the activities of the Maoist guerrillas and their political mentors who lead the Nepalese government. Even the radio and TV networks have skipped their headlines programs to protest the Maoist violence against the media. Also today, the Federation of Nepali Journalists are holding protest rallies throughout the country demanding a strong punitive action. The protests have garnered massive support from foreign missions and human rights groups. Diplomatic missions in Nepal, mainly the U.S. Embassy, the French Embassy and the Indian Embassy, have also condemned the attack, calling it a blatant, illegal and criminal assault on freedom of the press in Nepal. Nevertheless, such protests and condemnations have failed to bridle the Maoists who have threatened the two other media groups, the Kantipur and the Kathmandu Post. From Birganj in Nepal, I am PC Dubey.
Lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender rights groups around the world are reacting to the Pope's end-of-the-year speech to Vatican staff, in which he said, "The use of the term gender effectively results in man's self-emancipation from creation and from the Creator." Federico Mastro Giovanni reports from Rome.
Humanity is men and women, and if we talk about gender, we're opening the door to self-destruction. These are the words of the Pope Benedict XVI. The Church, explained Benedict, has to teach an ecology of man. This ecology doesn't have to protect just the rainforests, but also has to protect the human being from the destruction of himself. For the Pope, the nature of the human being is that of men and women, and it's important to respect this order of creation. In the words of the Pontiff, to disregard the language of the Creator and of the creation would mean self-destruction of man. The speech by the Pope has clearly generated much discussion about homosexuality. During one of the biggest economic crises in our history, said Aurelio Mancuso, president of Arcigay, the biggest gay organization in Italy, the Pope has this visionary nightmare against gays and transgender, and it doesn't let him feel the real pain of humanity, the huge crying of hunger, of injustice, of oppression, of billions of people in the world. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Federico Mastro Giovanni in Rome, Italy.
The EPA's Clean Air Interstate Rule, or CARE, has new life today after a federal appeals court ruled to reinstate it. Free Speech Radio News' Jess Burns reports.
The Clean Air Interstate Rule aimed to cut down on the amount of air pollution that travels between states on the wind by reducing the amount of smog-causing emissions. care mostly applied to states on the East Coast, but that rule was thrown out last July in a case brought by Duke Energy Corporation and other utilities that claimed there were serious flaws in the rules. Today's decision puts the regulations back into place until the EPA can develop a new clean air program. The judge said throwing out CARE entirely would be detrimental to public health. This ruling comes on the heels of an EPA report released yesterday showing that 100 million urban residents breathe air that exceeds the legal daily limit of particulate matter, or soot. The EPA added another 15 cities to their list of metropolitan areas in violation of the law, including Seattle, Fairbanks, Salt Lake City, and Madison. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Jess Burns.
Anti-government protests continue into a third week in Athens, where hundreds took to the streets after a gunman opened fire at a riot police bus. After a two-day break in the protests, students peacefully marched through Athens today. Protests were initially sparked when police shot and killed Alexandros Grigoropoulos on December the 6th. Discontent with high youth employment and the global economic crisis, along with government scandals and right-wing reforms, have shaken the conservative government. Some analysts say months of street protests could force early elections next year. For Free Speech Radio News from WMNF Community Radio in Tampa, I'm Nell Abram.
About 40 miles west of Knoxville, Tennessee, millions of gallons of ashy sludge have broken through a dike at a coal-fired power plant, flooding homes, burying roads, and threatening rivers and drinking water. Tom Kilgore is the president of the Tennessee Valley Authority, which owns the power plant.
I fully suspect that the amount of rain we've had in the last 8 to 10 days, plus the freezing weather and the expansion that the freezing in the ground causes, might have had something to do with this.
The holding pond contained about 70 acres of fly ash. That's the residue left over from burning coal. It often has elevated levels of toxic metals. And according to the EPA, the spill has released about 525 million gallons of the sludge. That's nearly 50 times the size of the Exxon Valdez oil spill. Ann Payne is covering the spill for the Tennessean.
They're still determining how they'll clean it up. They've estimated it could be several weeks of cleanup, though there are some other issues that have yet to be settled, and that includes figuring out exactly what's in the sludge. Coal ash is known to have a lot of substances like mercury and lead and other items that are not good to be either on land or in water, so they have to determine just what's in that ashy mix.
Are residents getting any kind of warnings on not touching the sludge or how to protect themselves from anything toxic it might contain?
That's a question I've got into TVA right now. When we've talked to residents, it appears that no one has told them this, that the primary concern so far seems to have been for what's reached the water. There's a lot of water testing going on right now, but there's not much notice about what's on the land.
How far could the spill spread?
Well, theoretically, if it rains today, depending on how hard it rains, it could push all this material into the little Emory River, which is right there beside the plant, which goes down and meets the Clinch River a few miles downstream, and then that goes into the Tennessee River. And so this could move all the way through the state via the Tennessee River. I mean, there's no limit to how far it could go.
I have to ask, how do you wind up with 525 million gallons of coal sludge perched uphill from your town?
Well, this is the way many coal-fired plants around the country have been dealing with ash for years. Some folks say it's an antiquated way of dealing with it, but they put it in these, the ash, they take it out of the plant, mix it with a little water, and then sluice it over to these ponds where it settles out. The water runs off. They move the ash into another pond, so eventually it's landfilled. But this is an unlined facility. It was built probably in the 1960s.
Again, that's Ann Payne, environmental reporter for the Tennessean. The spill comes as the Bush administration is considering last-minute regulations that would make it easier to dispose of coal ash in old mines, something that environmental groups are asking incoming President Barack Obama to reverse. Lisa Graves Marcucci is a community advocate with the Jefferson Action Group in Pennsylvania. Her community was buried by a similar spill in 2005. Lisa Graves Marcucci, thanks for joining me.
Thanks for having me.
How many coal ash pits like this one in Tennessee are there spread across coal country?
There are so many. I don't even know that we have a count on them. They take various forms. Each one of the coal-fired power plants usually have pits on site, and then they also take their waste, which is also called coal combustion waste or locally known as fly ash. They haul that away sometimes to landfills. Sometimes, like in Pennsylvania, they take them to sites and they deem it beneficial reuse of a waste. And so these pits are really around the sites of the power plants, and they're also embedded in communities. And in many cases, they're not logged as to where they are. I don't know that we have a full accounting of how many of these types of situations are really lurking in communities like mine or maybe yours.
Well, you have a new administration coming in. Are you looking for changes in policy on how this stuff is handled?
Absolutely. In fact, I was one of the signatories on a letter. We had 38 other grassroots organizations. On Friday, we sent a letter to President-elect Obama asking him to take a look at the situation with coal combustion waste. And what we fear is that the benign label, as I've explained, does give regulators a false sense of security that it really is just soil when it is not. And we also are concerned because the Federal Office of Surface Mining is currently considering, and we're probably days or weeks away from them allowing, abandoned coal mines to be filled up with all of this ash.
Lisa Graves Marcucci, thanks for joining us on Free Speech Radio News.
Thank you so much for having me.
Lisa Graves Marcucci is a community advocate with the Jefferson Action Group in Pennsylvania. Federal prosecutors have convicted five men on charges of conspiracy to attack the Fort Dix military base in New Jersey, but critics are accusing the government of entrapment and of persecuting the Muslim American community. Karen Miller reports from Washington.
Constitutional law professor Kay Ali Khan says in cases like this, there's usually two ways the government collects evidence. In the first scenario, the government will spy on, catch, and persecute groups that are planning to commit a crime.
The second scenario is where the government actually becomes part of the group, either through, you know, informants or through very active participants who are working for the government. And then these infiltrators, they not only plan with the defendants, but they actually entice them and coax them into saying things which could lead to a crime.
Some legal advisors say this is exactly what happened in the Fort Dix case. The FBI Planet paid informants who obtained hundreds of hours of audio and video recordings, which prosecutors say were used to show the group of five men were serious about the Fort Dix plot. James Seuss is the director of the New Jersey chapter of the Council of American Islamic Relations. He sat through several days of testimony.
If you look at the facts of the case, I mean, there was no real plot to specifically attack Fort Dix or anywhere else. There was no point where these five defendants sat down and talked about attacking anything. And a lot of the actions that took place in terms of buying weapons, in terms of acquiring a map, in terms of surveillance of Fort Dix, were cases where the informant played an active role in getting these things to happen. He was more than just a fly on the wall.
The case hinged on the legal definition of conspiracy, which means the jury only had to be convinced that the men were thinking about the attack. But Sue says the jury was also influenced by strong anti-Muslim bias in the U.S.
Some rather strong emotions that would be stirred by things that they have seen in the media regarding Muslims and jihad and terrorism, these kinds of things, and then ask them to be impartial in rendering a verdict in a case like this. It can be very difficult for Muslims being facing charges like this to find a fair and impartial jury, frankly, in the United States.
Muslim American Society Executive Director Mahdi Bray says the case plays on lingering fears.
Even the prosecutor actually had mischaracterized the case. I remember when this case first came up, it was characterized as the face of a new kind of homegrown terrorism, which really, in essence, it was not and has proven not to be. So I think that people who would like to sensationalize and still exploit the unfortunate tragic events of 9/11 for other agendas, certainly this provides more ammunition for them. But I think at the place we are in America that perhaps it will not have the type of effect that those type of individuals would like for it to have.
The men face the possibility of life in prison. Defense attorneys say they're considering appeals. For Free Speech Radio News in Washington, D.C., I'm Karen Miller.
Over the past month, hundreds of Philadelphia residents have taken to the streets to protest plans to close 11 of the city's 54 library branches. Holding read-ins, rallies, and marches, they've told Mayor Michael Nutter that closing their neighborhood's educational resource centers is not the right way to deal with the city's $1 billion deficit. FSRN's Andalusia Knoll has more.
It was a two-mile-long march, a long way for 50 elementary school students. But they made the trek, from the Charles Durham Public Library to the Walnut West Library, which will be their closest library branch if Mayor Nutter's proposed library closings go through.
2, 4, 6, 8 Durham branch is really great.
9-year-old Autumn of Montessori Genesis 2 School was among the marchers.
When you close libraries, it robs our community of education.
Students in the march said they use the library every week because their school does not have its own library. Many of Philadelphia's public schools rely on neighborhood library branches for the same reason. Hundreds of Philadelphia residents, young and old, black and white, gathered at a rally in front of the main branch of Philadelphia's Free Library in early December. Community organizer Gregory Benjamin of West Philadelphia addressed the crowd.
Because you know that we need education. You know that we cannot afford to lose our libraries. Again, this is not a political issue. This is a human rights issue. We have an entitlement to have libraries in our community.
Mayor Nutter has said that tackling Philadelphia's dropout rate of 45% and high crime rate is one of his priorities. Candace Carter of the Philadelphia Student Union says that by slashing library funding, he is doing the contrary.
If you get rid of libraries and get rid of students' resources to, like, educate themselves and help with their education in school, they won't have anywhere to go. Like, because it's bad enough they don't have enough resources in school. So if you take the resources outside of school, there's nothing left for them to do. It puts kids in a bad position of, like, they don't have nowhere to go and, like, they can get into bad situations.
Libraries across the country face similar challenges. San Diego Mayor Jerry Sanders has proposed temporarily shutting down 7 library branches, and library branches in New York City may be forced to reduce their hours. Jim Rettig, president of the American Library Association, says that when tax revenues are down, it is common for city governments to try to close libraries as an attempt to balance the budget. The association argues that libraries play a crucial role for people in times of economic crisis and called for library funding of $100 million as part of the federal stimulus package. Jim Rettig.
Libraries are providing an incredibly important service to their communities as the economy falters. There are many people who need to find information about job opportunities. They need help with resume writing. They need to submit job applications online but don't have access to a computer and the internet any place but in their library. In about 73% of the communities in the country, the only place you can get both a computer and an internet connection is the public library.
11 of the Philadelphia library branches are scheduled to close their doors on December 31st. Friends of the Free Library of Philadelphia have called for a moratorium on library closures while other cost-saving options are explored, and City Council has passed a resolution for a similar moratorium. Library supporters are threatening to sue based on a bill which says that no city-owned capital facility shall be closed without specific approval from City Council. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Andalusia Knoll in Philadelphia.
You're listening to Free Speech Radio News. Check us out online at www.fsrn.org. Next, part two in our series on homelessness in North America. We turn to Canada, where cold claimed the lives of two people sleeping on the streets this week. Aaron Lakoff has the story.
Canada's finance minister, Jim Flaherty, admitted last week that the country's economy was in recession and that the GDP would actually shrink for the first time since 1990, leading to massive layoffs. And meanwhile, as temperatures dip below freezing, an estimated 300,000 homeless people in Canada's biggest cities brace themselves for the hardships to come. AJ Withers works with the Ontario Coalition Against Poverty in Toronto. The group predicts that as a result of the economic crisis, people will come flooding into Canada's largest city in search of social services.
A lot of people across the province come from rural areas that don't have services for people who have lost their homes or don't have access to any kind of food security or income security. And so people will come in part looking for work, but in part simply trying to access relief from freezing cold temperatures or meals or services that exist in Toronto because we have a large, poor, and homeless population.
With Christmas around the corner, millions across North America are also giving to charities set up to help the homeless. The demand for Christmas charity assistance offered by the Salvation Army in Canada has risen between 15 and 20% from last year, and their holiday fundraising goal for 2008 has been set at $2.5 million. But according to Kathy Inouye, a housing rights organizer in Montreal, the charity given to homeless organizations isn't enough. The government must step up to address the lack of affordable housing. Canada is the only G7 country without a national housing program.
Because there's a huge recession we're going into, and one thing the government could really do, and they should do, is invest more in social housing at this point, even though everybody's all freaked out because we're going to go into a deficit. But this is really the moment where the government needs to invest a lot in infrastructure like housing. Once people have secure housing, then they can spend their money on other things.
In Montreal alone, homeless shelters are demanding an extra $3 million in funding from the provincial government in order to avoid any homeless freezing deaths in the future. While homeless shelters become overcrowded and start to reach their maximum capacity, those who have nowhere to go often face the worst consequences. And with the impacts of the global economic crisis now being felt in Canada, some are expecting one of the hardest winters in recent history. From Montreal, this is Aaron Lakoff reporting for FSRN.
Now to Egypt. 50 years ago, Egypt elected the Arab world's first woman parliament member. But despite the fact that women have enjoyed full political rights for decades, they haven't participated much in Egyptian politics. Now, President Hosni Mubarak is calling for women to participate more. From Cairo, Aya Batraoui reports.
The number of women in the 454-member Egyptian parliament is 9, and just 5 of them were actually voted in. The remaining 4 were appointed by President Hosni Mubarak. Rights groups in Egypt have long been calling for a quota system in parliament as a means of supporting women's political participation. Now, lending the movement a guaranteed stamp of approval, Mr. Mubarak told the members of his ruling party that he would support a fixed number of women in parliament. But the women here want more than just a namesake quota system. One Egyptian woman, a mother of 2 and lawyer, said she wants the women who are chosen or elected to parliament to be accountable to the people, not just to the ruling party who helped put them there.
We don't want a quota system that helps us only to then hurt us, meaning we don't want specific women chosen by the government to serve in parliament who don't actually have a say in decision-making or a positive purpose. We don't want the government to say that they brought us a quota system, now be happy and shut up. No, we want a quota system that works at a higher level than that.
But unlike in Egypt, where the law has not been introduced in parliament yet, neighboring Sudan already has an active quota system where 18% of parliament seats must go to women. And in the incoming session, women will hold 25% of the seats in the Sudanese parliament with a newly fixed quota system. Sudanese MP Magdariz says the quota system in her country has helped her and many others have a more active role in decision-making policies.
Women participate in all aspects of life, from politics to society to culture. So she is present in decision-making. And so long as she is present in decision-making, it can help other women.
Currently, the overall number of women in the Egyptian parliament is half of what it was in the late 1980s, when women held 18 seats. Yet it was also in the 1980s that a quota system to give women 10% of the seats in parliament was voted out. But due to President Mubarak's public support for a fixed quota for women, parliament could pass such a law. It is still unclear when that could happen, but rights groups are hoping that a quota system is approved by parliament next year. Reporting from Cairo for FSRN, this is Aya Batraoui.
Residents of Bethlehem are seeing the peak of their tourist season right now. The number visiting the Holy City to mark Christmas this year is expected to top 1 million. Thanks to the West Bank's economic isolation, tourism is one of the few sources of income that Palestinians living there can count on. But they're complaining that Israeli tour guides are stopping visitors from shopping in local markets. FSRN's Ghassan Banoura has more from Bethlehem.
Bethlehem, the birthplace of Jesus, has the largest Palestinian Christian community in the West Bank, but their Christmas is not all that merry. Luay Ayad is a Palestinian Christian from Bethlehem who used to work as a tour guide in both Israel and Palestine, but the Israeli government cancelled his work permit along with many other Palestinian guides in 2000. This year, there is an increase in tourism in Bethlehem, but Luay Ayad cannot do his guide work like he did in the past.
Because I don't have permission to work in Israel, I lost most of my work, and now I only make about 10% of what I used to make before. It affects me economically, especially during the Christmas celebration. Now I can't buy the things I need, such as clothes for my wife and I. We can only afford things for our kids now.
The economy in Bethlehem City depends, for the most part, on tourism and related work, such as souvenir manufacturing and retail shops to sell the products. Ronnie Dabash is the third generation of his family to run the family souvenir shop, located right next to the Church of the Nativity. Because most tourists come here on tourism packages sold to them by Israeli companies, the company guides stop the tourists visiting shops like Ronnie's.
We are not seeing any tourists coming to this market near the Nativity Church. Because, as we said, the problem, the tourists are coming, visiting the church and direct to the bus. So we need the tourists to go all around Bethlehem. They should give them maybe half an hour free tour in Bethlehem, shopping, to the restaurant, all over Bethlehem.
The Holy City is completely surrounded by the Israeli annexation wall and illegal settlements. Frequent Israeli army attacks on Bethlehem are effectively driving the local economy to the edge of collapse. And to worsen it, the Israeli tour companies and guides keep tourists away from the local shops by telling them the city is too dangerous. And for now, the increase in the number of tourists is yet to translate into something meaningful to the residents in Bethlehem. For FSRN, this is Ghassan Barnoura in Bethlehem, Palestine.
Free Speech Radio News is a worker-run collective. Catherine Comp and Vinod K. Joes produced today's broadcast. Leanne Caldwell is our Washington editor. Our headlines editors are Jess Burns and Nell Abram. Our technical production team at KPFA in Berkeley is Puck Lowe and Rose Katabchi. For archives of this or any other newscast or documentary, go to our website, www.fsrn.org. And please join us for special documentaries this holiday season. Tomorrow, Christmas Eve, we'll have a half-hour look at the case of the New Jersey Seven. That's a group of young, queer, black women who went out for a night in the town and wound up jailed amidst allegations that they were a lesbian gang. On Thursday, we'll take a look at youth-led organizing in Washington, D.C. that has challenged stereotypes, demanded change, and expanded opportunities for young people living in the nation's capital. That's all coming up right here on Free Speech Radio News. From KPFA in Berkeley, I'm Brian Edwards-Tiekert, sitting in for Auda Bogado.